Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest is the poet Paola Corso. Paola Corso's fiction and poetry books are set in her native Pittsburgh area, where her immigrant Italian family found work in the steel mill. Her writing honors include a New York Foundation for the Arts Poetry Fellowship and recognition on the Pennsylvania Center for the Book's Literary and Cultural Map. Corso's new poetry books are The Laundress Catches Her Breath, winner of the 2012 Tilly Olson Award in Creative Writing from the Working Class Studies Association, and Once I Was Told the Air Was Not for Breathing, featuring Pittsburgh steelworkers and garment workers in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire and in sweatshops today. She returned to Pittsburgh after living in New York City for nearly 20 years. Hi, Paola. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you back in Pittsburgh, and especially to have your poems. So you're going to start with a poem from your first book.
Yes, Death by Renaissance. And I'd like to lead with a little river prayer. In the name of the Allegheny and of the Mon and the Holy Ohio, amen. This poem is called Doctor Makes His Diagnosis, and the title refers to a Swiss doctor who coined the word nostalgia in a 1600s medical dissertation on homesick Swiss soldiers who were in the lowlands of Italy and France, and they pined for their mountains. I have two cities, but only one home that is my mother's womb, with one long umbilical cord that reaches across hundreds of frequent flyer miles. I have two apartments and one window filled with fleets of light and a sooty curtain that no matter the color is checkered gray. I have an abiding devotion to my birthplace, so when I go back to Pittsburgh, I'm stupida for living in Brooklyn, and when I'm living in Brooklyn, I'm mad with longing. I have an afflicted imagination that incapacitates my body, causing nausea, loss of appetite, high fever, pathological changes in the lungs, brain inflammation, and cardiac arrest. I have a lifeless and haggard countenance, an idleness conducive to daydreaming about thick village milk and Iron City beer, about the sounds of bagpipes and terrible towels whipping in stadium winds. I have three college degrees and seven bookcases, but rely solely on associationist magic. When I climb the stairs to the torch of the Statue of Liberty, I imagine being at the top of an idle factory smokestack. I have a highly contagious disease, but curable if you purge my stomach, induce torture and pain. I can be ridiculed, laughed out of my homesickness, unless you see me as a working-class woman who does a white-collar job with blue-collar hands. Now I'll read some poems from Once I Was Told the Air Was Not for Breathing. And this first one is the title poem, and it's based on the 1948 Donora inversion, which we know some people were killed in that, and it's known as the first known causes of air pollution deaths. Once I was told the air was not for breathing. I held my breath and counted backwards until my lungs began sucking in my body instead of the air that was not for breathing. If I were to be particular about the particulates, and I could, and I was, and I had to, for myself and for the memory of the 20 in the smog who blew from asphyxiation, waiting for a 130-pound tank of oxygen strapped on somebody's back, lugged from house to house in darkness, puffing them up with a little purity, and then gone for another who was just as particular about the particulates. The sulfur, carbon monoxide, heavy metal dust trapped in the river valley, and I imagined all of this as my lungs inhaled my face and neck and chest, stomach, legs, and feet, until I was all inside myself, and I took one look at my lungs, the sponge that was now aboard, with no give, no take, the color of an oil slick, the song of a worm, and I wanted out. This next poem is called Crane Dance, and I read this in memory of my grandfather, Francesco Antonio Corso. And there's a footnote to this poem. The line "Predictions of Science" refers to a University of Pittsburgh public health study on the relationship between a steelworker's exposure to cancer-causing agents and their mortality rate. Researchers found that the risk for lung cancer, leukemia, and other cancer was higher. My grandfather was a crane operator for 47 years before retiring. He died of leukemia in 1966. Crane Dance. 1. My grandfather's crane, spanning fire, long-necked, long-legged, teething molten bone. He rides with a sweatband above his brow, stroking its mechanical head to drop white-hot ingots into a trolley. He rides its flexion in crackled air to machine through night-shifting night. 2. My grandfather's crane, spanning fire, long-necked, long-legged, teething molten bone, as it becomes one of those predictions of science. In my dream, he doesn't die. I fold 1,000 origami cranes, and he rides in a vim of courtship dance. Pairs of birds whisk their wings and vault the air, high above the wintering ground.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Paola Corso. She's reading her poems. I wanted to ask you about the relationship in your writing between poetry and activism. I mean, it seems to be very clear and very strong, but do you feel that that connection sort of made you a poet, or did you always write and then, you know, this obsession with work came later? Or
I'd like to think of writing, whether it's poetry or fiction, any kind of writing, as a poetics of witness. And I'm witness to my family's working class background, their work struggles. And I'd like to have us pay attention to that, to acknowledge and validate that. Perhaps our words will move us to take some kind of action once we are aware of the injustices done. And there are so many when I think about, you know, what's gone on in Bangladesh and so forth, and I look forward to reading some sweatshop poems.
Oh, you're going to be reading some right
yes.
now.
Yes.
So are you saying that all poetry is a poetry of witness, or that's how you like to view your poetry?
That's how I like to view mine.
Okay.
I by no means place any standard on anybody else's
okay.
poetry, but for me, it's very important to bear witness.
Mm-hmm.
I want my words to be of use.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's my working class background. Everything must have some practical value.
Right.
And a poem isn't written for its own sake. In my background, my father wanted me to use my words for something very practical, public relations, newspapers, poems, not so, but I feel that I am putting them to, I'm working them
mm-hmm.
for a good use.
Do you feel like that ever gets in your way when you write? It becomes a restriction or a limitation?
That's a very good question. I just like the people's lives to speak for themselves, the details. Let the details speak for themselves. I don't want to hit anybody over the head with a ball-peen hammer. That's not the kind of poetry that I respond to.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to elicit emotion
mm-hmm.
and feeling. And if I do that, the rest will take its course.
Okay. Can you read some more?
Yes. So these are the triangle poems. In 1911, 146 immigrants, many Jewish and Italian teenage girls, lost their lives in this fire, factory fire, caused by locked doors and unsafe working conditions. Eyewitness, trapped behind a locked factory door so they wouldn't leave with a shirtwaist in their pocketbook when they finished their workday, leaping from sewing table to sewing table across the floor, choking in a smoky cloakroom as their dresses caught fire, pushed to the ledge by flames, crowding for air, windows popping, girls jumping three and four together, waving their arms to keep upright. They leave with their names and their light. Identified. Sophie Salemi, by the stitched knee of her stocking mama darned the day before. Ignazza Bellotta, the heel of her shoe the cobbler repaired with a metal plate. Mary Leventhal, the gold cap Dr. Sahario set on her wisdom tooth last week. Gussie Bierman, by the pendant watch she wrapped around her neck twice. Julia Rosen, the hair braids her daughter Esther fixed for her that morning. Rosie Grosso, the savings she wrapped in cheesecloth and hid in her left stocking. Kate Leone, by a blue skirt she wore to Randall's Island Hospital to visit her son. Jenny Levin, the baby's sock found tucked in the heel of her shoe. Anna Cohen, box number 31. Celia Eisenberg, box number 56. Julia Alberstein, box number 32. On the lid of one coffin written with white chalk, Becky Kessler, call for tomorrow. In this next poem, it's called Girl Talk, and I imagine what would the Triangle Girls say to all the workers today in sweatshops, in the garment industry, and the conditions that they continue to endure. Girl Talk. The Triangle Girls say to the Chinese girls, the Indonesian girls, the Vietnamese, the Taiwanese, girls, girls, take your 16-hour workday and glue it to the sole of the shoe. Take your 20 cents an hour wage and glue it to the heel of the shoe. Take the $180 he charges for the shoe and glue it to the padding of the shoe. And the Triangle Girls say to the Chinese girls, the Indonesian girls, the Vietnamese, the Taiwanese, girls, girls, take the room with six bunk beds and no place to stand and glue it to the arch of the shoe. Take the glue, glue, toxic glue, burning eyes, ringing ears, bleeding nose, and glue it to the glue of the shoe. Take the fans and vents you don't have, gloves, masks, and aprons you don't wear, and glue them to the threads of the shoe. And the Triangle Girls say to the Chinese girls, the Indonesian girls, the Vietnamese, the Taiwanese, girls, girls, take the chopsticks you can't hold at lunch because your fingers are too numb and glue them to the Velcro of the shoe. Take vertigo, headaches, vomiting, memory loss, shortness of breath, cancer, and glue it to the glue of the shoe. Take the glue, glue, toxic glue, and put it under his nose, a Nike nose, an anything goes nose, and make him sniff. This next poem is called Of My Eye, and I wrote it after a conversation that I had with a former ESL student of mine. One. Of my eye, the apple you set on my desk, delicious, red-streaked yellow, tiny enough to cup in the palm of my hand, Meilu. Woman, mother, student learning English, the words to say, you can't come to conversation club today. We'll miss you, I say, chalking the date, March 25th, 1911, on the blackboard to prepare for my lesson. Next week, yes? No. I work now. You found a job. Doing what? Seamstress. She smiles, takes the chalk from my hand, and draws pattern pieces. Tell me about the dresses you sew. How many pleats, how many cents, how many hours, how many times, while I look through thick bangs fringing your eyes and wonder. How many floors, how many escapes, how many doors will be locked? 2. Of my eye, the apple shaped as your heart, Maylou, woman, mother, student learning English, the words to say your teacher can't take a bite, hear the crisp, smell its sweetness break the air between us when I think of clenching my fist to keep you safe, to keep you all safe, not bolts of fabric. Once you leave the room, the apple on the windowsill, a glaze of light to see how you stood at the stalls of fruit with baby on your hip, one hand in a bin, holding each to examine skin and boundary. 3. Of my eye, your apple inside my coat pocket during the centennial march of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. We carry 146 blouses with sashes bearing the names of workers who perished, who sat at a sewing table as you now sit, bodies found leaning into their machines, huddled in the cloakroom, broken on the sidewalk below, shirtwaists raised to the sky, their delicate sleeves float the wind down Broadway. Every life borrowed, every life returned.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Paola Corso, reading her poetry. I want to ask you about the process of writing your poems, because some of them, I'm sure not all, I mean, are based on facts, are based on real occurrences around the world related to working conditions, tragedies that have happened. Do you find yourself writing like from news stories, or how much, it seems like a lot of research would be involved before you even start writing these poems?
Yes, I do research quite a bit, Jan. Newspapers, I go to libraries, I look up documents. For once I was told the air was not for breathing, I referred to the University of Pittsburgh study, union testimony, all kinds of things. But I have to tell you, my personal, emotional, visceral reaction is what begins a poem. It's not what I read in the newspaper. For example, this last poem that I read, Of My Eye, the irony that on the day that I led this conversation club and was going to discuss this Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, because my students were Chinese immigrants who I knew had this experience of hanging out on fire escapes, wondering, you know, if they were going to get caught by the immigration service. This student of mine laid this apple on my desk and told me that she was proud of this job working in a sweatshop. And I was just so moved by all of these coincidences that it compelled me to write. And I think that's what I prefer to do. I want to have the feeling myself first and be moved myself by people's lives, this details of their lives, and then go from there.
Right, right. Well, it looks like you've gotten support in from different places. You know, winning the 2012 Tilly Olson Award in Creative Writing from the Working Class Studies Association. So, I wonder if you do a lot of readings around the country at, you know, for workers, for what. I know there's a working class conference every year in Youngstown, for example. Is that where you do some of your readings?
Yes, that's where I'd like to do more, though. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to read poems and work to an audience that's very receptive to literature. I so appreciate that, and I appreciate that support. But I want to move more into exactly what you're talking about, Jan. Mm-hmm. I want to go to the workplace and mm-hmm. and be invited to read there to workers. That's my goal. That's my mission right now. I feel very strongly about that. So mm-hmm. I'm excited about that direction, and I hope that I can do that.
That would be great. And I imagine, you know, adopting some of your books for working class studies classes would be a great fit for that. Okay, you have some more poems to read?
Yes. I'm going to read now a few poems from the collection The Laundress Catches Her Breath. And putting pollution aside, we are told we live in the most livable city, but I ask for who. I know a laundress who is struggling to leave home, and I think there are many graduates, this new generation, that can't leave home because they can't find affordable work. We do mourn for the loss of those well-paid union jobs, but how about those who never had them? The laundress is one of them. Bias. She washes colors but prefers whites, bleaching streaks of yellow and mottled gray, grease on her apron from a shift at the fryer, stains that can't hide in dyes of mulberry or hunter green. She takes them on face to face like schoolgirls she fought and snapped in two. She walks away with a loose tooth that she yanks out, tarred from cigarette smoke. She couldn't get it white, no matter how hard she scrubbed. Step by step with the laundress. 1. It's easier to wash clean clothes if wearing clean clothes, a saying adapted from your college-educated uncle who says it's easier to find a job if you have a job when he hears you chewed out stubby for cutting back your hours. 2. Sort clothes in neat piles on the basement floor because the safe where your father, Mr. 20 Horn, stashes company photos for meal picnics and prayer cards for every deceased member of the family, alphabetized by saint. 3. Check pockets for matches, lighters, cigarettes left from break, a string of beads Unc bought for job interviews but you wore to bar bingo and stuffed in a pocket because it felt like bugs around your neck. 4. Load the washer, set the dial, and pour in double the detergent, knowing old man 20 Horns waters it down since you told him to stop buying the cheap Giant Eagle brand, or you'd quit doing his laundry. 5. As soon as the clothes are submerged in soapy water, have a cigarette and listen to Tom Jones until the line, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, she's a lady," or your butt burns out, whichever comes first. 6. When the load begins to agitate, drink your coffee on the porch beside your grandmother's scrub board and hand wringer the 20 Horns will make you use if his water bill gets any higher from trying to get the meal soot out of his work clothes and the soup of the day off of yours. 7. Hang a taut line. Keep a clothespin in your mouth as if smoking a cigarette while your friend Donna finishes your hoagie because her daughter ate hers and you gave yours up for adoption. 8. Group clothes and hang together, except don't put your 36D Hooter holders next to Donna's 32 AAA, because you know who will figure out you've been washing her clothes since she got fired and kick your arse all the way back to a laundromat. 9. Have a cigarette on the porch while the clothes dry, then check on your dying uncle next door as soon as your father stops yelling about getting another pay cut so you'll never get the hell out of his house. 10. Get rid of the wasp nest near the line because 20 Horns is too cheap to hire an exterminator and says you'll blow them away while you're with your smoker's cough. Tell him smoking like a chimney ain't as bad as him smoking what a stack at the mill belches out, so he'll get the cancer, not you. 11. Take clothes down from the line, then see if you can go offer to change your uncle's pillowcase next door because it's moist from his shallow breath and you suddenly need him to see you wearing the beads he gave you, if he remembers why. 12. Fold the clothes. Out of respect for your uncle, plan to wear a clean uniform from the basket if you need to visit the funeral home someday soon. Then go straight to work rather than call in sick. You want to believe in what he told you. I'm going to end with a poem called Blow Out the Candles. There was no twister out her window, no gale spinning a black cloud. She mused at the shingled pyramid floating above her. She dreamt her father climbed a ladder and tried to yank the roof down. Her uncle attempted to use reason. How long could it defy gravity? How long before she pictured a baby in her arms, each hiccup lifting the roof, lowering it, until she put the child on her breast and the roof grew still. But she missed the sky, she missed its blue mission, the clouds that pillowed her thoughts and elevated them to dream. She blew out her baby's candle as the pyramid drifted off. She knew it was her own breath reaching for the possibility of air.
It's the poetry of Paolo Corso. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment Newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.